I was talking with my brother several months ago, my natural brother, that is, and I was talking to him about my business that I had started in sales, and he's a businessman also, so he was giving me some pointers. And he said something like, "Well, you're already a salesman, basically. You're a salesman for God." And I said, "No, really, I'm not." And we talked about that briefly, and that got me thinking about this topic. And I want to talk about how churches are not businesses and preachers are not salesmen. There may be some very minor similarities between those things, but fundamentally they are very different. Now, don't get me wrong, I love business and I love sales. I'm not saying anything bad against those things, but our church is not a business. And as a preacher, I'm not a salesman. As in my business life, I am a salesman. I'm my own salesman, but not as a preacher. And it's interesting because I was trained and worked as an engineer in my former life. And anybody that knows, if anybody that is an engineer or that is a salesman, know that engineers and salesmen are like oil and water. They're like each other's arch nemesis. They pretty much despise each other. And for good reason. Salesmen think big picture, mile high, make all kinds of promises that nobody can possibly keep. And they're looking at the world, from the airplane, and the engineer's looking at it through the microscope and looking at all the details. And so Wayne knows what I'm talking about. And so anyway, in my previous life, I despised salesmen, and now I am one. So anyway, part-time anyway. But I would say if you do pastoring like sales, you're a hireling. And if you do preaching, or if you do sales, pardon me, like preaching, you're going to starve to death. Because you cannot, if I was a salesman the way I'm a preacher, well, I'm not all that successful at it anyway, but I would be much less successful than I am at this point anyway. Maybe that's part of the problem, I don't know. So anyway, I want to get into this. I want to give you a bunch of reasons why churches are not businesses, why preachers are not salesmen. But before I do that, I just want to give you a little bit of a primer that there is nothing wrong with honest business. I think some people have this idea that business is a dirty thing, it's a sinful thing, it's a necessary evil or something, and business people are all just a bunch of rich, greedy people, and they don't care about anything else but money and all these things. And so that's not true. That's not true of honest business. I'm not talking about cronyism. I'm not talking about people that live off of government contracts and fleecing the taxpayers and things. I'm talking about honest, real business. Businesses provide needs. They provide goods and services to customers, to consumers. If we didn't have business people, we wouldn't enjoy the living that we any of us live. Everything that we consume is made by some guy that took a risk and put a lot of money and labor and work into it and built something and produced something, a good or a service that we all enjoy. And it just drives me crazy when I hear about how businesses should give back. Give back? Why would they give back? They never took anything. I mean, give back, that's the idea that, well, you've taken something from society, now you got to give it back. They give to society. They don't take from society. Every exchange, every voluntary exchange is a mutually beneficial exchange. You only buy things, if you buy a phone, you buy it because you think the phone is more valuable than the money you gave for the phone, and the guy that sells you the phone thinks that the money is more valuable than the phone. You both think that each other's good is more valuable. So business people don't take anything. They give. They make our lives a lot better. Businesses that operate in a free market must satisfy their customers to stay in business. And if they don't, they go out of business. Unless they, get in bed with the government and create a monopoly or something like that. But I'm talking about real honest business. They compete with each other to create the highest quality goods and services at the lowest price. That's what they do. That's what happens in a market. I would say that business owners are benefactors of all mankind. And I would say personally, everybody loves to thank the soldiers. Thank the soldiers for their service. I don't thank the soldiers for their service. They bring us into bankruptcy, essentially, through, and I'm not saying them, but they are part of the system that brings us into bankruptcy with all these foreign wars. I'd say thank a business owner. Thank them for their service because they're the ones that really make your lives better. You might not agree with me. You don't have to agree with me. These are my, th this part is opinion, so you don't have to agree with that if you don't like it. Business owners provide jobs for the majority of the population who are not entrepreneurs. Most people are not entrepreneurs, right? And most people are perfectly suited to work for somebody else. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's fine. That's what the majority of people do, and that's what they're good at. I personally think that every person, Bev will know what I'm talking about because she was a business owner. I personally think that every person ought to try to start their own business. And you will have a renewed appreciation for business because you will find out that it is the hardest thing in the world. It is so hard. And anybody that's been there knows what I'm talking about. And I marvel now. When I drive down the road and I look at businesses and I just think, wow, how did they build that? I don't care how big or how small it is. How did they build that? They started from nothing and they started with an idea and they worked hard and they put a lot of money into it and they put in 18-hour days into it and 10 other of their competitors they're not here because they failed. These people are amazing, really. I'll be honest with you. I admire people that have created a business and made it work. It's very, very hard work. Being an employee is easy, right? We think being an employee, it stinks because you got to work for the man. You just got to take orders from him and you do all the work and he makes all the money. Yeah, right. Being an employee is the easiest thing in the world. You just show up, do what you're told and collect a paycheck every single week, whether the business is making money or not. You collect your paycheck. It's funny. People, they don't get it. But anyway, I didn't get it either until I got into that world. So let's just consider some of the men in the Bible that conducted business to make a living. I won't read you this verse, but you remember Mark 3:6 tells us that Jesus was a carpenter. It said, is not this the carpenter, the son of Mary? Right? Jesus was a self-employed carpenter. So he interacted in business for probably, I don't know, at least, 20 years of his life, I suppose. He probably started pretty young, and then he went into the ministry at 30 years old. Paul was a tent maker. He was he did some business on the side. Acts 18 and verse 3, he met Priscilla and Aquila there, and it says, and because he was of the same craft, he abode with them and wrought, for by their occupation they were tent makers. I don't know if he was self-employed or he'd worked for somebody else. Or at this point, I think he was probably just helping them out because they all did the same thing. But anyway, Paul was conducting commerce, right? Nothing wrong with that. It's not like you're getting your hands dirty in the things of this world if you are involved in business. Not at all. We looked at this last time in the sermon that Peter, James, John, Andrew, all of those men were fishermen and they worked with their father. And I'm guessing they were self-employed. That boat that they were on probably was their boat. And they probably put in their own money and bought that boat and worked hard at it. The virtuous woman in Proverbs 31, she worked from her home, produced girdles, and sold them to the merchants. So she was a businesswoman, working for home and for the benefit of the home. But nevertheless, she was involved in commerce. Proverbs 31:24. Absolutely nothing wrong with that. These crazed lunatics that are taking over the political scene today, and I don't mean only the politicians, but they're just representative of the crazed lunatics that support them, that just hate business. And they just think, they just tax businesses to death and raise the corporate income tax level. And these people are crazy. They're trying, some of these, like Elizabeth Warren and people like that, they want to do a wealth tax where they not only tax your income, they want to tax, now this is for rich people, but they want to tax their wealth at 2% or 6% or 8% per year, every year. So if you have money in your bank account every year, you give 2 or 6 or 8% of that to the government every year. These people are absolutely insane. That's how they want to pay for this universal health care stuff they're talking about. And now I just heard that Warren wants to tax unrealized gains that you make in the stock market or other investments. So if you bought a stock at $10 at the beginning of the year and now it's worth $15, you would pay tax on that gain, even though you haven't sold the stock and you haven't actually realized the gain. These people are insane. It's crazy. Don't get me wrong, I'm no fan of Trump whatsoever, but they're worse in some respects anyway, that's for sure. But yeah, these people are nuts. Anyway, Lydia was a seller of purple. Acts 16 and verse 14. The only good thing is if Trump gets in again, Republicans are going to go to sleep for another 4 years, and everything is going to continue on as it is, and he's going to keep blowing the deficit up by $1 trillion a year and taking guns away and everything else. At least if Warren or one of the other loonies gets in, the Republicans are going to wake up again, and anybody that has a brain is going to resist this, and she's probably not going to be able to institute any of this crazy stuff that she wants to. So who knows? I don't know. I honestly don't know which one of them would be worse. So anyway, Acts 16 and verse 14. Lydia, this was another female woman business or businesswoman. Acts 16:14 said, "And a certain woman named Lydia, seller of purple of the city of Thyatira, which worshipped God, heard us, whose heart the Lord opened, that she attended unto the things which were spoken of Paul." So she was a godly businesswoman, a converted businesswoman. She made purple and sold it, and then she was converted to the truth. The Lord opened her heart, and then she received the things that were spoken in that order, not the other way around. I think a lot of people think that they open their own hearts by believing, and then they receive or something. It's not how it works. Okay, so there's nothing wrong with business. But like I said, a true church is not a business. And I'm going to give you 8 reasons for this morning. So reason number 1, businesses exist to make profits. And I think that's the only reason they should exist. They should exist to make profits. By making profits, of course, they have to offer a good product at the best price and to attract somebody to buy it from them. So by pursuing profits, they make the rest of our lives better. But that's the only thing they should do. They're not there really to provide jobs, though they will do that inadvertently by making profits. They're not there for political activism. They're not there to promote social justice. They're not there to serve the community or to be partners with the government or anything like that. Business has nothing to do with any of that. A lot of times businesses do some of those things because they want to look good in the public eye and blah, blah, blah. It's all a bunch of fake charity, if you ask me. The ones that I've been around, it just makes me disgusted. They can't go 5 minutes without telling, oh, don't forget about the walk to cure cancer this week and everybody come out or whatever. It's just a bunch of fake charity, I think. It makes me disgusted. But anyway, businesses exist to make profits, but true churches are not profit-seeking corporations, right? We talked about on Wednesday that God's people are required to support the church and God's work financially, right? Proverbs 3, 9, and 10, honor the Lord with thy substance and the first fruits of all thine increase, so shall thy barns be filled with plenty and thy presses shall burst out with new wine. But that's a far cry different from being a profit-seeking institution and being driven by money. There's certain, most churches anyway, need a budget to survive. Actually, this one doesn't, which is interesting. I was just thinking about this today. Do you know, does anybody know offhand, the grand total, the number, the revenue number that this church has collected from its members or anybody else in the last 4 years since it was instituted? Does anybody know the number? Zero. We've never set out a box for this church ever. Ever. For the church. Right? You guys support the ministry, right? You know, but for the church itself. I told you when we started this church, I didn't even start a church fund. I just said, lay by yourselves in store. Take some of your Lord's money, put it in an account. When we have a need, I'll bring it before the church, and there better be some money there for it, or else somebody's going to be in trouble, right? Because I don't want to be collecting every week and keeping a big pile of money somewhere, and we don't need to do that. You know, in 5 years in Minneapolis, you know what the grand total of the revenue of the Minneapolis church was? How many dollars we collected while I was there? Zero. None. They had some money before I started, and then really our only expense was the room, and it wasn't all that much, and I realized, you know what? I've got Lord's money I need to do something with, so I paid for the room, and I never put the box out one time to collect anything. We just never needed to. There was no need for it. So yeah, church is not a... I'm not saying, obviously, putting out a box is fine if you have expenses for the church. There's nothing wrong with that, but I'm just showing you that the church is not a profit-seeking institution by any means. God's church, Jesus taught, is not a house of merchandise. Look at Matthew 21 and verse 12. Matthew 21 and verse 12. Now, how many of these churches down the road are you going to go to and find out that their annual budget is zero? Right. Outside of what they give in support of the pastor. Probably not many. You know, granted, they have buildings and all that, so they do have some legitimate expenses, but usually they kind of exist to perpetuate themselves and yeah. They're not exactly in it to serve, be for the primary purpose of serving God, most of them, I don't think. Matthew 21 and verse 12. It says, "And Jesus went into the temple of God and cast out all them that sold and bought in the temple, and overthrew the tables of the money changers and the seats of them that sold doves, and said unto them, It is written, My house shall be called the house of prayer, but ye have made it a den of thieves." A den of thieves. And then he says in John 2 and verse 16 that they were not to be making it a house of merchandise. You see, these people had turned the religion of God into a money-making institution for the benefit of essentially the bankers of that day, the money changers. That's what bankers are, right? Their table, which was their bank. They had set up a system, as I understand it. When you came to the temple, you could give in the temple currency, so you had to do exchanges. And of course, I'm sure the exchange rate wasn't very good, and they were taking a little off the top. And then you had to have approved animals that you could sacrifice, so that required you to exchange the money and then purchase the animal. And it was a racket. They were making all kinds of money off the religion of God. And Jesus Christ was so angry in there, he went in and overturned the money changers' tables. It would have been an incredible thing. You ever heard gold and silver coins like fall on the ground, just that sound? It would have just been coins all over the place. And I would have paid almost anything to see that, especially what we're about to read here. Whenever he took the scourge of small cords and started beating those guys out of the temple, I would have loved that. Verse 16, we'll just start with verse 14. "And found in the temple those that sold oxen and sheep and doves, and the changers of money sitting. And when he had made a scourge of small cords, he drove them all out of the temple, and the sheep and the oxen, and poured out the changers' money, and overthrew the tables, and said unto them that sold doves, Take these things hence, make not my Father's house an house of merchandise. And his disciples remembered that it was written, The zeal of thine house hath eaten me up." Jesus was zealous for the house of God. It was to be a house of prayer, not a house of merchandise. Merchandise is the action or business of buying and selling goods or commodities for profit, the exchange of commodities for other commodities or for money. And that's essentially what was happening there. Exchanging money for temple money and for commodities for animals and sacrifices and so on. Totally corrupt. That nation, at the time when Jesus came, was a habitation of devils. They were just full of iniquity. Jesus said, "Fill ye up the measure of your fathers." Israel was as bad as it had ever been whenever Christ came at that time. All right, number two reason why churches are not businesses, and that is that corporations are created by the state, which is their head. But that is not the case of a true church. I'm going to give you some quotes here. I'm going to prove to you what I'm saying. I've told you all this stuff before, but I've never actually given you quotes from court documents, court cases to prove it to you. So I'm going to show that to you. I think this is very interesting. So the fact is, whoever creates a thing owns it and controls it. If you create something, you are the owner of it. You are the controller of it, right? Well, the state is the one that creates corporations. Therefore, they own and control it. They have power to regulate corporations because the state legally created them. Now, churches that are unincorporated, that are incorporated, that are 501c3 non-profit corporations, are creations of the state and are therefore under its rule and jurisdiction. And this is not just some theoretical idea out there. This is the fact. This is absolutely true. That churches that are 501c3 nonprofit corporations, which are all of them virtually, aside from the Churches of Lake Faith with us and very, very few others, almost every single other church out there, the vast majority of them are incorporated, are nonprofit corporations, 501c3 tax-exempt corporations. And they are creatures of the state. They have been created by the state, they're owned by the state, they're controlled by the state. And then they will complain about the fact how the state is telling them what they can preach and they can't endorse candidates and they can't do this or that. They got nobody to blame but themselves. They are the ones that signed on the line to be incorporated. They are the ones that asked the state to make them a corporation. You can't get upset with the state for controlling you whenever you went to it to ask its permission to exist. I'm going to give you here some excerpts from Pastor Ben Townsend's book, Approved by God. Great book if you're interested in this topic. He says here, this was on page 91. He says, this case of Lehman versus Piggly Wiggly. Anybody ever, you know what Piggly Wiggly is? Anybody? Yeah, it's a grocery store down south. Okay, yeah. The first time I saw a Piggly Wiggly down in South Carolina, I think it was, I just thought that was so funny. It was the funniest sounding name. I've never heard of it before. But anyway, this case of Lehman, I think, sorry. Yeah, this case of Lehman versus Piggly Wiggly is one of a multitude of cases which define the true nature of a corporation. The case hinged on whether or not the H.S. Lehman Company had been formally dissolved. The opinion of the court defined the existence and creator of the corporation and whether or not the court could, quote, resurrect, unquote, the corporate, quote, life, unquote, to continue the action. The court stated, quote, a corporation exists by force of legislative enactment. Its inception and the duration of its power are determined by law. And these laws have fluctuated in time and place. There is no uniformity now among the states on the subject. When the time approaches for its dissolution, whether it shall be struck down or divested instantly of all power, or shall be permitted to linger with diminished or diminishing powers until it sinks into innocuous desuetude, which is disuse, is dependent on the will of its creator as expressed in legislative enactment. And who shall have the right to question its existence and the measure of its powers is likewise determined by the author of its being. In Ohio, that sovereign will is expressed by the General Corporation Act. So in Ohio, and this is the way it is in other states, everything is a little bit different, but the general principle is the same. The state legislature created the General Corporation Act, and that is the statute by way corporations are brought into existence. They are brought into existence by the will and power of the state. Therefore, they are owned and controlled by the state. They can be divested by the state. They can be diminished by the state. They can continue by the state. But it's all according to the state's will going through the courts. Now, what happens is a lot of churches that started out as true churches, like this one, we could go down to, I don't know where you go, if it's Clay County or what county is it? I guess we meet in Clay. What, I don't know if it's Clay County or if it's the state of Missouri. I don't know how it would work. But anyway, we would go somewhere within this state and apply to be a nonprofit corporation. And we would, I guess, members or I don't know how they would do it. Anyway, you'd sign the document. They would appoint trustees out of the church members. So certain members would be trustees because all corporations have to have trustees. And then we would become a corporation. And most churches do this because of the tax benefits, and they're tax exempt, and the donations given to the church are tax exempt, which, by the way, people talk about that as like a negative thing, why people wouldn't want to go to an unincorporated church because you can't write off your giving on your taxes. You can't write off your giving on your taxes unless you itemize anyway. And most people don't itemize. Most people take the standard deduction, I think, anyway, my understanding. And if you take the standard deduction, you can't write off charitable giving on your taxes anyway. So it's not really that. I mean, people make a big deal out of that, and it's not really a big deal at all. But anyway, it wouldn't matter anyway. You don't give to God so you can get a tax break. Anyway, it's ridiculous. So anyway, that's what churches have done. What I just described there, what I read in the court document, that's what churches do when they become a corporation. And then they are subject to the will of the state. Here's another one for you. This is page 92. The case of the Syrian Antiochian St. George's Orthodox Church versus Guise, G-H-I-Z-E, in the Supreme Court of Massachusetts sustained this reasoning when applied to a church. The court said, quote, in its nature, an act of incorporation is not, listen to this, is not a contract between the corporate body and the individuals composing it. I'm thinking, I would bet that most people think when a church incorporates, it is a compact between the church members and the corporation that the church has now been formed into. So it's just a compact where the members say, okay, now we are the part of Excelsior Springs Church Inc. or what, or Excelsior Springs Church Inc. or whatever. And that's the agreement. That's the corporate agreement that we own the corporation. That is not what incorporation is. Listen to it again. It is, okay, it is, in its nature, an act of incorporation is not a contract between the corporate body and the individuals composing it. It is a compact between the creating government on the one side and the created corporation on the other side. When you create it, when a church becomes a corporation, the compact is not between the members and the corporation. The compact is between the corporation, the corporate body, the legal entity, and the government. That's what the compact is. That's the two parties of the compact. The corporation can come to an end only by some act of the sovereign power by which it was established. It can be extinguished under our laws only by the general court acting within the appropriate scope of the legislative power, by the judgment of a court of competent jurisdiction, or by proceedings for surrender of charter or dissolution under some statute. So this is the court ruling here. So churches, a lot of times they incorporate just because that's what you're supposed to do, right? That's just what everybody tells them to do when they first get started. And then some of them come to their senses and realize, wow, we shouldn't have done that. And then they just want to say, okay, well, we're just not going to be a corporation anymore. It's not that simple. You have to go back to the court and you have to subject yourself to all that stuff. And you got to go through all the legal proceedings with all the lawyers and all that stuff. You can't just say, no, we're just done. You can't. When you subject yourself to that, you've got to go through their rules to unincorporate. And that's what the Ecclesiastical Law Center does. They've helped churches do that. It's a big headache. Here's some more quotes from court cases proving that incorporated churches are under the jurisdiction of the state. There's so many. I mean, I guarantee you go to these churches down the road. You go to some, you know, these Baptist churches or whatever churches right here in town, and they would tell you, we're not under the control of the state. We're a sovereign church of Jesus Christ, and he's our only head, and no state government's going to tell us what to do, and we're not going to marry anybody we don't want to marry, and we're going to do whatever we want to do, and da-da-da-da-da. Yeah, right. You wait till they come down and put their iron fist on you, and you're going to find out. You're going to do exactly what they say because you are a creature of the state. Gibson versus Munson. Here's a quote for you from a court case, 1988. Having elected to incorporate under the laws of the state, they should be required to conform to the consequences of their voluntary act. That's just how it works. If you voluntarily incorporate, then you are under the power of the state and you do what they tell you to. Here's another one, Matthews versus Adams, 1988. When the members of the church decided to incorporate their body under the laws of the state of Florida, they submitted themselves to the jurisdiction of the state courts in all matters of a corporate nature, such as accounting for funds. You realize that. If this church or any church incorporates, they could be brought into court and have their books wide open and where'd you spend all this money? I want to see an accounting for every penny you spent. You think about that. Here's another one for you. Methodist Church of Newark versus Clark. Where there is no incorporation, those who deal with the church must trust for the performance of civil obligations to the honor and good faith of the members. So if, like our church, when we are unincorporated, if somebody, like let's say we did have a building. We don't, but if we had a building and we wanted to get a new roof put on the building or something, and we couldn't do it ourselves, which we could. We have talent in this church, but let's just say we couldn't, and we hired somebody to do the work for us. They would just have to trust us. We're not a corporation. We have no insurance. They would have no recourse. They could not sue us. You can't sue this church. You realize that. Nobody can sue this church. Nobody can bring this church into court. Impossible. You cannot bring this church into court. You know why? Because this church doesn't exist as a legal entity in the eyes of the state. Who are they going to bring into court? The Excelsior Springs Church that doesn't exist as far as the state's concerned? They can't bring us into court. They could sue one of us individually, but they can't sue the church. There will never be a lawsuit against the Excelsior Springs Church. It is impossible. And if they ever tried, we wouldn't show up. They don't have jurisdiction over this church because this church is a spiritual body. It is not a corporate legal body. Now, that's liberating right there. Now, granted, I mean, it would not be a place, it wouldn't be a fun place to be. But anyway, there have been churches that have, I mean, there are churches that, support the Law Center, and they have been, they've tried to bring those churches into court for various things. Usually it has to do with the building. They wanted the local fire chief wants to inspect the building, and they say, sorry, you can't. You're not allowed. This is God's building. We are not going to bring ourselves under your jurisdiction and your authority for you to come in here and tell us what to do. We're sorry, but you can't. And then they try to take him to court, and they're like, well, you can't take us to court. We're not a corporation. We are not a legal entity. So they can try to take the pastor to court, but who's the pastor? He's just the pastor. He is not the church. True churches are created by Jesus Christ, not by the state. Remember what Jesus said in Matthew 16 and verse 18? He said, upon this rock will I build my church. I will build my church, Jesus said, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. Whose church is it? Jesus Christ, not the state of Missouri's, or not any other state's. It's Jesus' church. He built it. And therefore, he is the head of the church, the only head. Look at Colossians 1 and verse 18. And he is the head of the body, the church, who is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in all things he might have the preeminence. Now let me ask you a question. If this was an incorporated church and we had to abide by the rules of the state and they could come in and audit us or look at our books or tell us how many fire extinguishers we had to have in our building if we had one or whatever, any little trivial thing or any big thing, tell us who we could marry or who we couldn't marry or whatever. Who has the preeminence in this church? Not Jesus Christ. They do. The state does. But the state doesn't have the preeminence in this church. I don't care if the state does say we have to marry sodomites. I will never marry a sodomite. Well, myself, personally, I certainly would never. And I would never marry two sodomites together, let me put it that way. And the first one's true also. You don't have to worry about that. I worked with a guy one time, and he had made a post online or something, and he said that my brother married my brother, and I was the best man. And everybody's just sickened by it until you realize that his brother was a preacher who married his brother to a woman, and he was the best man in the wedding. So, anyway. My brother married my brother, and I was the best man. So it was pretty clever, I thought. True churches are only under the rule and jurisdiction of Jesus Christ. As I think it was Stephen Beatty said, the church is not some two-headed freak show. You know what something with two heads is called? A monster, right? The church does not have two heads. The real church, anyway. The church cannot have two creators. It cannot have two heads. It cannot have two masters. You can't serve two masters. You only serve one or the other. And if you're incorporated, what are you going to do? You're trying to serve two masters. You're trying to serve Jesus Christ, and you're trying to obey the dictates of the state as well. And you can't. Number third reason why churches are not businesses, is that corporations, both for-profit and non-profit, have boards of directors. Now, you're going to search the scriptures in vain to try to find a board of directors in the New Testament church. You will search the scriptures in vain to try to find, trustees in the Bible. Now, you go to these other fake churches like what I came out of, and they had a board of trustees. And I grew up thinking, well, that's just one of the offices in the church, the trustee, you know, like Paul said, and he gave some apostles and some prophets and some evangelists and teachers and some trustees, right? You read about that in Ephesians, or was it 3 Corinthians or something like that? But anyway, it's in there somewhere, right? There are no trustees in the Bible. There's only one leadership office in the Bible, and that is of the bishop / pastor / elder / overseer / steward. And I've done sermons on this before showing that those are all the same office. That is the only leadership position in the church. Look at Hebrews 13, 7 through 7 and 17. Hebrews 13 and verse 7. Remember them which have the rule over you, who have spoken unto you the word of God, whose faith follow, considering the end of their conversation. Them that have the rule over you are the ones that have spoken to the word of God. In other words, the preachers, right? They're the ones that have the rule over the church. Under the Lord Jesus Christ, of course. We don't rule according to whim or just do whatever we want. We execute the laws that Jesus has put in his word. Verse 17, obey them that have the rule over you and submit yourselves, for they watch for your souls as they that must give an account, that they may do it with joy and not with grief, for that is unprofitable for you. This verse shows us that the ones that rule the church are the overseers of the church because they watch for your souls, right? They oversee. That's why a pastor is called an overseer or a bishop, which is a bishop is by definition an overseer. Look at 1 Timothy 5 and verse 17. I'll show you that this pastor, teacher, overseer is also called an elder. 1 Timothy 5:17. He said, let the elders that rule well be worthy of double honor, especially they who labor in the word and doctrine. See, the ones that teach are the ones that have the rule. They're the elders, right? Elder, bishop, pastor, overseer, it's all the same office. And Paul wrote in Acts chapter 20 and verse 28 to the elders at Ephesus, and he told them in Acts 20 and verse 28 to take heed, therefore, unto yourselves and to all the flock over the which the Holy Ghost hath made you overseers to feed the church of God, which he hath purchased with his own blood. You see, obey them that have the rule over you, who have spoken unto you the word of God. The ones that speak the word of God are the overseers in this passage that feed the flock. And what is a feeder of the flock? A pastor. Pastor, overseer, bishop, elder, steward, it's all the same office. It is the one who has the oversight and the rule of the church. And you can see the series that I did on one pastor and church government where I covered all that stuff in great detail and showed that the church only needs to have one pastor, unless it's very large and it would have need for more than one. All right, number four. Fourth reason why churches are not businesses. Businesses exist to satisfy their customers' demands. Okay, that's true. That's what businesses exist to do. Satisfy customer demands. But a church exists to satisfy God's demands. We don't have customers. I guess you can say people that come in to visit are customers or something. But you know what? Visitors or members are not customers. And we do not tailor our service to anybody's demands except for God's demands. Including my demands as the pastor. We don't tailor the church to my demands, because if I start demanding things that are unbiblical, guess what? You need to tell me there's the door. We satisfy God's demands. Remember, it says there in Colossians 1:18 that in all things Christ might have the preeminence. He is the head of the body. Remember what Jesus said in Matthew 28 and verse 20? Matthew 28:20. These were his parting words when he left this earth to the ministers of his church. Matthew 28 and verse 20, he says in verse 19, go ye therefore and teach all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Ghost, teaching them to observe all things whatsoever. I hate that. Hold on. My throat's so dry I can't talk. That was a terrible place to have to take a drink. Let me start again. Teaching them to observe all things whatsoever I have commanded you, and lo, I'm with you always, even unto the end of the world. Jesus says, you teach them all things whatsoever I have commanded you. So who do we exist to satisfy? Whose demands do we exist to satisfy? Jesus Christ's demands, and only his. Now, whereas businesses are there to satisfy their customers, preachers sometimes have to preach the opposite of what their congregation wants to hear. That's just how it works. Look at 2 Timothy 4, 2 through 4. You know what I would be if I preached only what you want to hear all the time? A hireling. I'd be a fake, false, pathetic pastor. 2 Timothy 4, 2 through 4. Paul tells Timothy, preach the word, be instant, in season, out of season, reprove, rebuke, exhort with all longsuffering and doctrine, for the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but after their own lusts shall they heap to themselves teachers having itching ears. So yeah, the preacher, the church does not exist to satisfy the demands of the people that sit in the church. Sometimes we have to tell them exactly what they don't want to hear. In business, the customer is always right, as the old saying goes, right? But I hate to tell you, in church, members and visitors are not always right. Sometimes they outright need rebuked and they're wrong. Church is not a business. Number five, fifth reason why churches are not businesses. Businesses operate according to the rules dictated by the state. Now, this is not the way it should be, but it's the way it is. Businesses should be able to serve whomever they want, I believe. And I know this is terribly politically incorrect, but I mean, I take this. There are Christians now that say a business should be able to serve, so they should be able to not bake the cake if they don't want to, and they shouldn't have to serve certain people if they don't want to. And they're exactly right. But you know where it started? It started back in the civil rights movement. Now, I'm not saying that some bigoted businessman should not serve people of a certain color or a certain ethnicity. I think he'd be a fool. I think it'd be wicked to do so, and I think he'd be a fool to do so. And the market would put him out of business for doing so, but I still think he has the right to be a bigoted idiot if he wants to and only serve Chinese people or Indian people or black people or white people or whatever. He could serve anybody he wants. He could hang up a sign in his restaurant that says, Japanese only. And I'd be fine with that. I just wouldn't go. And neither would anybody else because they would kill him on social media. But he should have the right to say that he wants to serve whoever, whomever he wants. It's his private property, if he's not, especially if he's not a corporation. If he's just an LLC or a sole proprietorship, he should be able to serve whoever he wants. Businesses are not public goods like they try to tell us. It's not public accommodation. You don't owe the public anything. You serve whoever you want. I mean, my wife runs a kitchen for only one customer. That's me, typically. Once in a while, we have some people over for dinner. But can you imagine if somebody from the community just knocked on the door and said, yes, I'd like a steak sandwich, please. Like, no thanks. Well, I'm going to sue you then because you have to supply whatever I want. No, I don't. It's my own house. Get out of here. Business owners should be able to do the same exact thing. It's called rights. It's called personal property. They shouldn't have to bake the cake if they don't want to. They shouldn't have to serve flowers to a sodomite if they don't want to. They shouldn't have to do anything they don't want to do. But churches, on the other hand, are not under the authority of the state. Remember what Peter said in Acts 5:29, we ought to obey God rather than man. Matthew 22 and verse 21, Jesus said to render unto Caesar the things which are Caesar's and unto God the things which are God's. Right? We don't render to Caesar the things that are God's. Yeah, we personally pay our taxes and all those kind of things. But as a church, we are not under Caesar's thumb. Caesar has no business in this room. He has nothing to say about what is preached in here, what is believed in here. He's got nothing to say. We're not under his authority as a church. Like I said, the local church belongs to Jesus Christ and operates only according to his rules. And we've already looked at those verses. He built a church. He says, do whatsoever I command you. Number six, sixth reason that churches are not businesses. Businesses thrive on innovation. And if they don't innovate, they go out of business, right? Churches must avoid innovation. Let me give you a verse, Deuteronomy 12 and verse 32. Let me tell you what, someday, Lord willing, I'm probably going to be here for a while, but someday in 40 years from now or however long, when I'm dead and gone, hopefully this church is still here, and if you call another young pastor, you make sure he's not an innovator. And you're all going to be dead and gone too, but for that matter. But anyway, whoever's around, or if I die tomorrow, let me just put it that way, maybe I get hit by a bus tonight or something, and you call another pastor, you make sure he's not an innovator. He comes in, I got some great ideas for this church, and I've got these big plans. Go somewhere else. We don't want big plans. We don't want bright ideas. We want you to do it exactly the way the Bible says, and don't add to it, and don't diminish out from it. That's what we want. Look at Deuteronomy 12 and verse 32. Here's what the Lord said to Israel. What thing soever I command you, observe to do it, thou shalt not add thereto nor diminish from it. Well, I think it'd be a good idea to have a keyboard in this church. It might help us sing a little better. No, you don't add to it. You don't diminish not from it. The Bible says, sing to yourselves, making psalms and hymns and spiritual melody in your heart. Something to that effect anyway. And there could be any number of other things. We don't add to it. We don't take away from it. Churches must keep the ordinances as they were delivered. Look at 1 Corinthians 11, verses 1 through 2. You know, unleavened bread just doesn't taste that great. I think why can't we just make some nice, big, fluffy, tasteful bread? I mean, that'd be better after all, right? No, we keep the ordinances as they were delivered. Well, I don't like the taste of wine. I'd rather have grape juice. Well, I don't care what you want. We're going to have wine because that's what the Bible, that's what Jesus used in the Bible. 1 Corinthians 11, 1 through 2, "Be ye followers of me, even as I also am of Christ. Now I praise you, brethren, that ye remember me in all things and keep the ordinances as I delivered them to you." Well, feet washing is kind of gross. It's just kind of weird, especially in the winter. It's just a pain in the butt. And I just don't like, you know, having somebody else touch my feet. I don't care what you like. I don't care what you think. We're going to wash feet. And if you don't like it, then go somewhere else. There's lots of other churches. We don't thrive on innovation here. Churches must strive for the faith which was once delivered unto the saints and never alter or update it. Look at Jude 1 and verse 3. Jude 1 and verse 3. "Beloved, when I gave all diligence to write unto you the common salvation, it was needful for me to write unto you and exhort you that ye should earnestly contend for the faith," not a faith, like there's a whole bunch of them out there or something, "the faith which was once delivered unto the saints." It was delivered one time, and we strive for that faith. We don't add to it. We don't take away from it. Churches must never adopt the traditions of men into their services. Look at Mark 7, 6 through 13. But for a business, businesses do bring in the traditions of men. Businesses look at how other successful businesses are doing it and they follow suit. Businesses never, they're not going to be doing the same thing today that they were yesterday, or they'll go out of business. There are very, very few businesses that never change. I would say some of them would be like candy bars, Pop, Pepsi, Coke. They never change their recipes, right? Because they don't want to. People love the history of that. But they still change their marketing. They still change their packaging. They change other things. But they don't change the actual product. But most businesses are constantly changing, right? They're trying to improve. They're trying to make things better. That's business. But that's not church. Look at Mark 7, 6 through 13. Now, of course, we personally want to become better. We personally want to become more righteous and more godly. But we're not trying to adapt and mold the church into something that would be more appealing to the world. That we must not do. Mark 7 and verse 6. "He answered and said unto them, Well hath Esaias prophesied of you hypocrites, as it is written, This people honoreth me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. Howbeit in vain do they worship me, teaching for doctrines the commandments of men." You see, they're bringing in men's ideas and teaching those for doctrines. We can never do that. "For laying aside the commandment of God, ye hold the tradition of men as the washing of pots and of cups, and cups, and many other such like things ye do. And he said unto them, Full well ye reject the commandment of God, that ye may keep your own tradition." And that's the problem right there with tradition. Because if you keep a tradition of men, you are going to have to reject the commandment of God. Somewhere along the line, those two things are going to come into conflict, and you're going to have to modify God's commandment. That's the problem with bringing in traditions of men. "For Moses said, Honor thy father and thy mother, and whosoever curseth father or mother, let him die the death. But ye say, If a man shall say to his father or mother, It is korban, that is to say, a gift, by whatsoever thou mightest be profited by me, he shall be free." God says, honor your parents, and when they get old, you're supposed to take care of them if they're in need. But the Pharisees came up with this idea of korban, that I have purpose to give all my income to the Lord. I've dedicated it all to the Lord, and it's all God's now, and I'm not in control of it anymore, unless I really need something, or, you know, other than that. But other than that, right, this is God's money. I can't do anything with it. And then your parents come to you, and they're poor and destitute in their old age, and then you say, sorry, Mom and Dad, I've given it to the Lord. This is dedicated to Him. I can't help you. That's what korban was. It is a gift. I've given it to the Lord. I can't help you. They had made null the commandment of God to honor your father and mother. by their tradition. And ye suffer him no more to do aught for his father or his mother, making the word of God of none effect through your tradition, which ye have delivered, and many such like things do ye. Catholic Church is full of this stuff, and most of the other churches have followed suit. They have brought in their own traditions. They do all kinds of things. Most of the things that they do are not to be found in the Bible. Number seven, seventh reason why churches are not businesses is that businesses must adapt to changing tastes of the public and be seeker-friendly. Churches must be steadfast and unmovable when it comes to the faith and practice and never capitulate to men's desires. We have to be we just have to stand, and we don't move. When the winds of public opinion blow upon us, we don't move. We don't move to the right or to the left. We just stand fast. That's what we must do. 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 58. You just really have to learn not to care. Just don't care what other people think. I couldn't care less. It cracks me up when people say, I could care less. You ever, people say that all the time. I could care less about that. Oh, really? So you do care some because you could care less. What they really mean is I couldn't care less. I hear that all the time. It's funny. I could care less. Anyway, 1 Corinthians 5 and verse 58. Therefore, my beloved brethren, be ye steadfast, unmovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, for as much as ye know that your labor is not in vain in the Lord. Steadfast and unmovable. That's hard to do in today's hurricane of false doctrine that we live in, and where public opinion is so against us. Even religious public opinion is so against us, but we just remain steadfast. That's what we must do. Now, if we were a business, we would go out of business really quickly, but we're not a business. And guess what? If this church, quote, goes out of business, and we all just, you know, evangelism's dead and we all just die off eventually, then guess what? I don't care. We kept the faith, and then who's ever left will go somewhere else and will join another church. I hope it doesn't happen. I hope the Lord gives us a revival, and I hope people, God's lost sheep, come in. I hope so. But if not, I don't care. I will not change anything in this church to try to bring in other people, to try to bring in visitors. I will not. Churches must never change with the time, with the times. Churches must only seek those whom God is seeking, those who desire to worship Him in spirit and in truth. You hear about seeker-friendly churches. They modify how they worship God based on what they have learned the public out there likes and wants. They're seeker-friendly. So they look at the people that are seeking to find a church, and they say, oh, they like instruments, they like rock bands, they like motivational speeches, they like Starbucks in the auditorium, they like all kinds of other things. That's what they want. That's what we'll give them. We are a seeker-friendly church. We seek those whom God seeks, and God seeks those who desire to worship Him in spirit and in truth. John chapter 4, 23 through 24. Jesus said, but the hour cometh, and now is, when the true worshipers shall worship the Father in spirit and in truth, for the Father seeketh such to worship Him. God is seeking. God's seeking people who are seeking to worship Him in spirit and in truth. God is a spirit, and they that worship Him must worship Him in spirit and in truth. I knew this preacher one time. He was one of the guys, I think, that took part in starting the church that I grew up in way back, right around the time I was born, I think. And he was an old man by the time I knew him. And I met with him one time. My dad wanted me to meet with him so I could get straightened out, because I was all screwed up in the head doctrinally. And he thought that this guy was going to be able to fix me up, because I'd been deceived and gotten into a cult and all these things. So anyway, I met with the guy, and he was now involved in church planting. And what they would do is they would look at a geographical area. They'd look at a certain town or city or county, and they'd see what the population is and how many churches are there and how many churches are per capita. And they'd say, oh, well, you know, there aren't very many churches per capita in this neighborhood. We'll plant a church in this neighborhood. That is the way of the world. That's how you start a business, not a church. That's exactly how you start a business. And that's why he was doing it that way. He was starting a business. Made me sick. All right, number eight. Last reason why businesses or why churches are not businesses is that businesses measure their success by how large they are and how fast they're growing and by how much profit they're making. But churches dare not ever make themselves of the number. Look at 2 Corinthians 10 and verse 12. 2 Corinthians 10 and verse 12. We don't ever want to get caught up in the ways of the world. The world says if it's bigger, it's better. Not when it comes to godliness, not when it comes to the church. It just size is immaterial, really. Bigger could be better, smaller could be better. It just totally depends. Right? Look at 2 Corinthians 10 and verse 12. Paul says, "For we dare not make ourselves of the number or compare ourselves with some that commend themselves, but they measuring themselves by themselves and comparing themselves among themselves are not wise." We should never compare ourselves with another church. Right? You guys are from the Detroit church. Now, if we were comparing ourselves and saying, they've got 100, we've got 11, therefore they're better. They're a better church than we are, we'd feel pretty crappy about ourselves, wouldn't we? Wouldn't we? And Pastor Mott would have a head so big he couldn't even walk through that doorway, right? But that's not how it works. That's not how it works. Pastor Ma doesn't think the Detroit church is any better than any of the other churches that are smaller. And I don't think that they're any better than us or we're any worse than they. It's got nothing to do with it. Nothing to do with it. Jesus' church was a little flock. He said in Luke 12:32, you don't need to turn there, but he said, "Fear not, little flock, it's your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom." So just because a church is small doesn't mean that it's not Christ's church. The size of a church has nothing to do with its success. Remember what Zechariah said? Zechariah 4 and verse 10, he said, "Who hath despised the day of small things?" You know, God doesn't, he doesn't look at things the way that we do. Whenever God was picking David to be the next king, they brought all the sons of Jesse in front of him, and they started with the eldest and went down to David the youngest, and they paraded all of them in front of him, and surely this is the Lord's anointed, this is the one the Lord has chosen. Samuel said, "Is there anybody else?" Well, yeah, there's just David, just this little boy here. And he brings him up. And Solomon, or Samuel, said that the Lord doesn't look at outward appearance. The Lord doesn't care about that stuff. He looks at the heart. Size is immaterial. Jesus said to a church in Revelation chapter 3, he said that they had a little strength, and yet God had set before them a door which no man could shut. Revelation 3 and verse 8. He said, "I know thy works." This is the church in Philadelphia. One of the two of the seven that were not censured in the book of Revelation. He says, "I know thy works. Behold, I have set before thee an open door, and no man can shut it. For thou hast a little strength, and hast kept my word, and hast not denied my name." A church with a little strength can have a big door open in front of them. You just never know what the Lord could do. And a small church with righteousness is better than a huge church without it. Look at Proverbs 16 and verse 8. Proverbs 16 and verse 8. It says, "Better is a little with righteousness than great revenue without right." There's a lot of churches in this town that are a lot bigger than this church. Right? They got big buildings. They got big congregations. But you know what? I'd rather have a little bit with righteousness than great revenues without right. I told you the story about the guy that said I should apply for the job in the Baptist church down in Kansas City that only had, I forget how many was it now, like 2,000? They only had 2,000. They'd lost a whole bunch, and then their pastor had left, and he said, "Oh, you should apply." And I said, I'd already told him that we had 11 members. 1,100? No, 11. No, just 11. He says, "You should apply." I said, "I'm happy where I am." And he just looks at me like I have two heads, like, "Wait, you realize there's like, you know, 100 times as many people down here, right?" Yes, I recognize that. A small church doesn't equate to an unzealous church. Just because it's small doesn't mean it's unzealous. It could be, but it doesn't mean that it is necessarily. And a big church does not equate to a compromised church. Don't ever look at a bigger church and say, "Well, yeah, they're bigger because they're clearly cutting corners," right? No, not at all. It doesn't mean anything. God could build a big righteous church. He could build a small righteous church. It's totally up to him. Size has nothing to do with it. Worshiping God in truth does. That's the only thing that matters. Is the truth preached there? Then it's good enough for me. Whether there's 7 members or 7,000, it doesn't matter. Now, there's nothing wrong with being an honest salesman either. Remember we looked at there's nothing wrong with honest business? Well, there's nothing wrong with being an honest salesman either. The role of a salesman is to uncover a need of a prospect and provide a solution to it. I don't think a lot of people realize that. That's what a salesman is really there for, a good salesman. He's there to uncover a need, to find whatever it is you really need, a problem or a pain in your life, and then to prescribe a solution for it. That's what a salesman's there for. A good salesman doesn't try to trick a prospect into buying something. A good salesman helps another person or company do their job better and more successfully. That's what a salesman does. Sales, contrary to popular opinion, is an honorable profession. But what do most people think? When you hear the word salesman, what do most people think? Sleazy, shysters, polyester suits, used car salesmen, liars. That's what most people think of salesmen. And some of them are. But that doesn't have to be the case. So there's nothing wrong with salesmen, but a preacher is not a salesman. Not at all. I'm going to give you 7 reasons for that. Reason number 1, preachers are not salesmen. Salesmen have something to sell. Preachers don't have anything to sell. I've got nothing to sell. I have things to declare. And that's it. I'm not selling anybody anything. To sell is to give up or hand over something to another person for money or something that is reckoned as money, especially to dispose of merchandise, possessions, etc., to a buyer for a price to vend. I've got nothing. I'm not giving anything away. I'm not asking for anything. I'm just preaching the truth. That's it. There's no price tag on the gospel. I love that song, Blessed Are They Who Go Preaching Without Price But Trusting God, teaching as did the apostles, walking in the paths they trod. I've got nothing to sell. Now, if you need a website, on the other hand, come talk to me. I'll sell you that. But I've got no gospel to sell, that's for sure. True preachers are not in it for the money. Look at this is why I read 1 Timothy 3 this morning. 1 Timothy 3 and verse 3. One of the qualifications for the ministry is that a pastor cannot be given to filthy lucre. Why do you think this is one of the qualifications? Because there are a lot of pastors out there, especially in these big, big corporate things, that are clearly in it for the money. That wouldn't be there if there wasn't a lot of money to be had in it. L. Ron Hubbard, the guy that started the Church of Scientology, he is said to have said, I think he denies this, but it is said that he said, he was a science fiction writer, and he said that he was going to get out of writing science fiction and start a religion because, quote, that's where the money's at. I don't doubt a bit that he said it. He's become, I don't know if he's even still alive, but he became quite wealthy building that very bizarre cult. I don't know if you know anything about the Church of Scientology, but it is as strange as they get. Very, very odd. And I've know about a lot of religions, and Scientology tops the cake. That one is bizarre beyond bizarre. Anyway, 1 Timothy 3 and verse 3. Not given to wine, no striker, not given to filthy lucre, but patient, not a brawler, not covetous. Not given to filthy lucre. Lucre is gain, profit, pecuniary advantage, now only with unfavorable implication, gain viewed as a low motive for action, pelf. And then it gives the phrase filthy lucre there. Pecuniary is consisting of money, exacted in money. So somebody who's greedy of filthy lucre is greedy of money. They want to get a lot of money. And this is why Paul made this a qualification in both of his pastoral epistles. In Titus 1 and verse 7, he says, for a bishop must be blameless as a steward of God, not self-willed, not soon angry, not given to wine, no striker, not given to filthy lucre. Now, I'd say anybody that pastors most of the true churches that we know of, if they're pastoring for the money, they are fools, right? Because you'd have to be a screw loose to think that, oh, I want to get rich. I'm going to be a Sovereign Grace Independent Baptist preacher, whatever. That's probably not the case with most. First Peter 5 and verse 2. 1 Peter 5 and verse 2. Peter says, "Feed the flock of God which is among you." These are men that are already elders. "Feed the flock of God which is among you, taking the oversight, not by constraint, but willingly, not for filthy lucre, but of a ready mind." This is something every pastor's got to be careful with. He should never make a decision based on money. Because as I was talking about last Wednesday, you can imagine that there could be a lot of pressure on a pastor whenever he's got a wealthy church member and thinking, oh man, this guy, I know he just committed an excludable offense and it's known by a bunch of people. But boy, you know, he really gives a lot. How am I going to make it? How am I going to put food on the table? There'd be a lot of pressure. And that's why a pastor must never be given to filthy lucre. You just cannot care about money if you're a pastor. It doesn't even come into the equation. Whatever has to be done, period. Never make a decision on money when it comes to being a pastor anyway. False teachers who are covetous make merchandise of the sheep. They're in it for the money. And there are lots of these guys out there. 2 Peter 2 and verse 3. Peter says in 3, he's speaking of false prophets here, false teachers. "And through covetousness shall they with feigned words," so they're pretending to be something they're not, "with feigned words make merchandise of you, whose judgment now of a long time lingereth not, and their damnation slumbereth not." Feigned words, they make merchandise. So they're making money off of people. In a sense, they are profiting by the sheep. And you think about all those televangelists, those guys have robbed more little old ladies, more widows, more people that are in despair and see those shysters, those wicked reprobates on TV, telling them to send them their money and they'll be blessed for it. And they have robbed those people of so much money. And I think there's a special corner of hell made for those people. That's evil. False ministers are in it for the money. Remember Samuel's sons, it was said of them that they had gone after filthy lucre. They had not followed in Samuel's ways. 1 Samuel 8 and verse 3. I'll just read this one to you here quickly. You don't really need to turn there if you don't want to. "And the people here were complaining to Samuel that he was getting old, and they said, and his sons walked not in his ways, but turned aside after lucre and took bribes and perverted judgment." Took bribes. I mean, they were making money off the people. I don't know what the bribes were for exactly, but they must have had something they could offer the people or some judgment that they could withhold from the people or something by giving them money. Don't ever try that with me, because not only will I have you excluded for the sin that you're going to be excluded for, then I'll have you excluded for bribery and anything else I can think of as well. A preacher cannot serve God and mammon. Look at Matthew 6 and verse 24. Jesus said you can't serve two masters. You're either going to love the one and hate the other, or you're going to hold to the one and despise the other. Matthew chapter 6 and verse 24, "No man can serve two masters, for he will either hate the one and love the other, or else he will hold to the one and despise the other. Ye cannot serve God and mammon." Cannot. It's not like, well, you know, it's a tight rope to walk. No, you can't. Impossible. All right, number two reason that preachers are not salesmen. Salesmen chase after prospects and follow up with them. And I know all about this, believe me. If it was the old days and I was paying for phone calls, I'd be bankrupt right now. I have literally made thousands of phone calls in the last 9 months. Literally, I'm not even joking you. Preachers don't chase after people, or at least they shouldn't. Maybe some of them do. I don't. And preachers shouldn't. I act completely differently as a preacher than I do as a businessman, as a salesman. Now, of course, I'm honest and ethical in both roles. I don't mean that I'm like some two-faced hypocrite or something. But the way that I go about sales and preaching are completely opposite. Nothing, not even similar or related in any way. As a salesman, I contact prospects. As a preacher, I let prospects contact me. I'm not out there. You know, somebody leaves a YouTube comment, and I'm like, "Hey, what's your phone number? I'd like to get a hold of you. I'd like to learn about you." I don't do that. I don't even dream of it. As a salesman, if a prospect doesn't return my call, I follow up with him again and again and again and again, many times. Now, if he says no, I never follow up again. But some people, you just can't get a hold of them. You call and they're not in the office, and you just keep calling and keep calling and keep calling until you eventually get a no. And then when you finally get a no, I'm just happy. I'm relieved. I'm actually looking. I'm either looking for a yes or a no, but a no's good. But yeah, I follow up if they don't call back. As a preacher, if a person doesn't call back or come back, I let them go. You're not going to hear from me again. I'm talking about non-members, of course. You know, if one of the members in the church just disappears and I don't hear from them, well, you're going to hear from me, believe me, right away. I'm not talking about members, but I just think it's irritating. I'm sure we've all been visiting churches before, and you visit a church. I don't know if you've ever been there. I've been there before. You visit a church. They find out your name when you walk in the door. They announce it to the entire church during church. Hey, so everybody, Wayne Hatcher's here. Make sure you say hi to him or whatever. Highly embarrassing, highly irritating. I've tried to sneak in churches before unawares so that they don't even know I'm there. And sure enough, somebody finds me and asks me who I am and then announces me to the whole church during the service. Like, what is wrong with people? I'm not talking about true churches. I'm talking about these fake ones that I've just gone to visit just to see what they were like or something. Really annoying. And then they'll, you know, you visit one time, you just don't like it, and then they're calling you up and say, hey, where are you? Coming back? It's like, really annoying. If the gospel I preach doesn't attract them, then I don't try to attract them with worldly methods. I basically just preach the word. And if they want to come back, great. And if they don't want to come back, well, that's fine. But I don't try to attract anybody with worldly methods. When the gospel offends somebody, a true man of God lets them go. Look at Matthew 15, 12 through 14. You don't see Jesus chasing after people in the gospels. As a matter of fact, read through your Bible, read through the four Gospels, and note how many times, and it's going to be the majority of times, when somebody needed healing from Jesus, he told them, come here, bring them to me. Rarely did Jesus ever go to them. He always tells them, you come here. When Naaman the Syrian needed cleansed, and the little girl, the slave, said, oh, that there was the man of God in Israel was here, and they sent Naaman to the king, first of all, and the king said, you go to Elijah. I think it was Elijah or Elisha. I think it was Elijah. No, it was Elisha, I think. And he came to Elisha. Elisha didn't go to him. You come here. Matthew 15, 12 through 14. Then came his disciples and said unto him, knowest thou that the Pharisees were offended after they heard this saying? And he answered and said, oh, tell them I'm really sorry. I didn't mean it that way. And I just kind of misspoke. I should have said that differently. Just tell them it's okay. You know, don't be upset. He answered and said, every plant which my heavenly Father hath not planted, shall be rooted up. Let them alone. They be blind leaders of the blind. And if the blind lead the blind, both shall fall into the ditch. Jesus says, oh, they were offended by what I said? Let them alone. That's what he said. Hosea 4 and verse 17. I'll give you a couple more examples. The Lord said here that Ephraim was attached to idols. He says, let them alone. Hosea, I need to memorize Caroline's Bible song so I can find these Old Testament books. Hosea 4 and verse 17. He says, Ephraim is joined to idols. Let him alone. Don't go chasing after him. Say, oh, Ephraim, you might want to reconsider this idolatry. You know, God doesn't like that. And, you know, maybe if you come back to him, maybe he'll be nice to you. And let him alone. That's what he said. Hosea 5 and verse 15. The Lord says, I will go and return to my place till they acknowledge their offense and shall seek my face. In their affliction, they will seek me early. He says, you know what? They've offended me, and I am not going back to them. I'm going back to my place, and they're coming to me, God says. And when they're finally ready to acknowledge their offense, then we'll talk. And one more, Jeremiah 15 and verse 19. I don't go chasing after people. Now, if I have said something wrong and offended somebody, of course, I would go apologize. And there's plenty of times as a preacher you say stuff that you didn't, you know, came across wrong, or just something stupid you shouldn't have said, or whatever. I mean, any number of things. And I will obviously apologize if I've done something wrong. But I'm talking about just if the gospel offends somebody, I'm not chasing after him. Jeremiah 15 and verse 19, "Therefore thus saith the Lord, if thou return, then I will bring thee again, and thou shalt stand before me. And if thou take forth the precious from the vial, thou shalt be as my mouth. Let them return unto thee," he tells the prophet, "but return not thou unto them." He says, you let those people return to you, Jeremiah. Don't you go chasing after them. Heretics are to be rejected, not chased after. Remember what it says in Titus 3 and verse 10, "And heretic after the first and second admonition reject, knowing that such is subverted and sinneth, being condemned of himself." And I never chase after people that have been excluded from the church. Never. That's why you know this is not a cult. Cults don't let you out. We don't let you stay in if you sin against the Bible. And we don't go chasing after you either. We hope you come back, but we don't go chasing after people. There's one exception to this in my ministry, and that's when I just had some questions and I really wanted to try to understand what happened, what was going on in somebody's head or things that I didn't understand. And I have called up a person one time to try to figure out what happened. And I made it very clear to him, first thing, I am not trying to get you back. I am not calling to mend fences or anything like that. I've just got some questions if you'll answer them. That's the only exception. Number three, preachers are not salesmen. Salesmen try to persuade prospects to buy what they're selling using psychology. Preachers don't use enticing words of man's wisdom, or at least they're not supposed to. Right? Paul said, "When I came unto you preaching the gospel, it was not with enticing words of man's wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit and of power," he said, in 1 Corinthians 2 and verse 4. Preachers don't give sales pitches. They declare the truth boldly. Paul asked for prayer in Ephesians 6:19 that he would speak the word boldly as he ought to speak. In Acts 4:11 through 13, when Peter made that proclamation that neither is there salvation in any other, and there is none other name given under heaven among men whereby we must be saved. And when they saw the boldness of Peter and John, they remembered that they had been with Jesus. Right? Preachers declare the truth boldly. We don't give sales pitches. We don't give altar calls and try to beg and plead with people to come down and get saved or something like that. That's not how they get saved anyway. They get saved by God, not by my preaching or by their belief or anything else. I never try to persuade people to visit or join our church. Now, I let them know that they're welcome to visit, of course, right? I'm not rude. I may be rude in speech when I preach, but I'm not rude personally. I'm a pretty nice guy, I think, most of the time. I preach from the pulpit what seekers should do, but I don't try to personally convince them, right? The majority of my ministry is right here. It's from the pulpit. The majority of what I teach and what I counsel is from the pulpit. I don't generally follow up with people personally unless you're heading for a brick wall or something and I feel like I've got to say something. Seekers should be asking me what they should do in response to hearing and believing the gospel. I shouldn't be asking them what they want to do. Look at Acts 2 and verse 37. This is a biblical altar call right here in Acts chapter 2. In most churches, it's the preacher asking and begging and pleading and seeing what the sinner wants to do, what the new convert wants to do. But that's not the way it's supposed to work. Acts 2:37, "Now when they heard this, they were pricked in their heart and said unto Peter and to the rest of the apostles, Men and brethren, what shall we do?" They asked the preacher, "What do we do?" Peter wasn't asking them. Look at Acts 8 and verse 36. I'll give you another example. "Whenever Philip met the Ethiopian eunuch coming back from Jerusalem, and he preached the gospel to him, told him about Jesus Christ, showed him how Isaiah 53 was referring to Christ. And in verse 36, "And as they went on their way, they came unto a certain water, and the eunuch said, See, here is water. What doth hinder me to be baptized?" The eunuch's asking him, Is there a reason I can't get baptized? Here's water. There's enough of it. And Philip said, yeah, if you believe with all thine heart, thou mayest. And he said, I believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. But he was asking Peter, or not Peter, Philip, what do I do? So I should not be asking people if they want to get baptized, you want to join the church. I don't do that. I let them come when they're ready to come. Number four, fourth reason why preachers are not salesmen. Salesmen would never say anything offensive to a prospect. You'd be a fool as a salesman to offend your prospect, to tell them they're wrong or to insinuate that they made a bad decision or that they whatever they have now is a piece of junk and they need something better. You'd never do that. You would never say anything offensive to a prospect. You're always really nice. That's going to be one of my other points here. But the gospel that pastors preach is offensive to sinners. Right? Paul said, if I verily preach circumcision, then the offense of the cross would cease. Galatians 5 and verse 11. The preaching of the cross is offensive. It is a stumbling block. Peter said in 1 Peter 2:8 that it was a stumbling block and a rock of offense. It's an offensive thing. Sometimes preachers even call names and condemn wickedness. And that's offensive. That's what happened there in Matthew chapter 15. Matthew 15, I don't know if I'm going to read the whole thing or not, but Matthew 15 in verse 7. Yeah, this is the passage that we already read. He called them hypocrites. He said they drew nigh to God with their mouth, but their hearts were far from him. In vain they worshipped him. And then they said, well, they were offended at that. Jesus said, I don't care, essentially. Number five, fifth reason why preachers are not salesmen. Salesmen would never rebuke a prospect and tell him that he's wrong. But preachers often rebuke church members, tell them that they're wrong. Titus 2:15, Paul says that these things teach and rebuke with all authority. 1 Timothy 5:20, he said, them that sin rebuke before all that others may fear. You don't do that when you're a salesman. You start rebuking people, you are not going to make it. Rebuke is to beat down or force back, to repress or check a person, to repulse, to reprove, reprimand, chide severely. Let me tell you what, you go take Dale Carnegie's class on how to win friends and influence people. It's not by doing that, I can tell you that much. Sixth reason that salesmen, that preachers are not salesmen, is that salesmen are always nice, usually. I mean, a successful one is. You ever meet a rude, unkind salesman? Maybe you have, but you certainly didn't buy anything from them. Salesmen are always nice, right? But preachers are not always nice. Like I said, I'm personally usually pretty nice, but when I preach, I'm not always nice, right? Sometimes preachers come across downright mean. Look at Jesus, Matthew 23. Tell me if this is what you would describe as nice. Matthew 23, 13 through 15. But woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for ye shut up the kingdom of heaven against men. For ye neither go in yourselves, neither suffer ye them that are entering to go in. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for ye devour widows' houses, and for a pretense make long prayer. Therefore ye shall receive the greater damnation. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for ye compass sea and land to make one proselyte, and when he is made, ye make him twofold more the child of hell than yourselves. I wouldn't consider that nice. That's typically, you know, when I make a sales call and I call somebody up, I normally don't start off the conversation with, woe unto you, hypocrite. You know, that probably wouldn't work out. I guess I should try it sometime just for fun, but I don't think it would probably end up in a sale. 25 through 28, woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for ye make clean the outside of the cup and of the platter, but within they are full of extortion and excess. Thou blind Pharisee, cleanse first that which is within the cup and platter, that the outside of them may be clean also. And he goes on to say that they're whited sepulchres. Not exactly Mr. Nice Guy. Remember the sermon I did a long time ago called Jesus Christ was not some soft, syrupy, sissy man or something like that? I gave you a whole sermon full of that stuff. Now, fake hireling pastors are nice, and they walk softly. They're nice, smooth, never say an unkind word, never tell you you're wrong. Look at Jeremiah 23 and verse 32. They're all smiles. Guys like that just make me sick. The people that are too nice, you know, I don't like people that are too nice. Because usually they're not that nice. I have met on occasion that people, like some people, you know, they're too good to be true. You've met people, you've heard about people like that, and they're just so nice, and you just think, they just can't be that nice. I have met on occasion people, I'm thinking of a certain woman in particular, that really is that nice. That she's just that super sweet and nice, and she's really not. But there are some people, you know, you've met them before. Church ladies, right? You ever go to a church and visit, and you get the church ladies, you know, the real nice, sweet ones. You know, that as soon as you turn around, stab right in the back. Bless his heart as she stabs him in the back, right? Jeremiah 23 and verse 32. Jeremiah 23, 32. Behold, I am against them that prophesy false dreams, saith the Lord, and do tell them, and cause my people to err by their lies and by their lightness. Yet I sent them not, nor commanded them. Therefore they shall not profit this people at all, saith the Lord. Their lies and their lightness, their light, they tread lightly, they walk on eggshells, they don't want to hurt anybody's feelings, right? They're soft, they're refined, just very nice. Lightness is the quality or fact of having little weight of a vessel, the fact of being lightly laden. Pastors like that are lightweights, and they're worthless. Real pastors are not soft and light. Look at 2 Corinthians 1 and verse 17. 2 Corinthians 1 and verse 17. Imagine having Joel Osteen as your pastor. Just get up here and smile all for an hour and tell you what wonderful people you are and how beautiful and awesome you are. How God is so much better off that he has you. He's so lucky. 2 Corinthians 1 and verse 17. He says, when I therefore was thus minded, did I use lightness? Or the things that I purpose, do I purpose according to the flesh, that with me there should be yea, yea, and nay, nay? Paul wasn't one of these yea, yea, nay, nay. He wasn't saying yes and no. He'd tell you either yes or no. He'd tell you the truth. Not wishy-washy. Let me give you one more example. Turn back to Ezekiel 3 and verse 9. Here's what a real pastor has to be. A real pastor has to have a forehead made of flint. It's not the easiest thing, especially if you have some rebel in the church that is going to stand up and charge you with heresy, try to lead the church away into heresy. You have to have a flint forehead. Ezekiel 3 and verse 9. The Lord says to Ezekiel, as an adamant harder than flint have I made thy forehead, fear them not. Neither be dismayed at their looks, though they be a rebellious house. I may be nice, but let me tell you what. And by the way, you know, if you have a disagreement with me, you can come talk to me about it. If I've said something and you're like, you know what, I think you didn't quite have that quite right. People have done that just recently. Judy did that. Judy showed me it. She's like, I read that differently. And I looked at it and said, you know what, you're right. Actually, I've been reading that wrong my whole life. You can come talk to me. But coming to me and trying to declare what the Bible says is heresy and then trying to lead the whole church into heresy, that's a different story. You're going to be met with a flint forehead, and I will not back down, and it's not going to be pretty. Number 7 reason why preachers are not salesmen. Salesmen follow a carefully crafted plan as they interact with prospects in order to increase the chance of a sale. I've read a book on it, and the sales is an art and a science. It really is. It's quite fascinating. But preachers just preach the word and let God sort it out. I don't have some carefully crafted plan. Most of the times when you hear a sermon, there might be a reason for it. Something came up, something I know of a situation, or something just popped into my head and I do a sermon. But a lot of times it's not some grand 4D chess plan where I'm trying to figure out how to convert the world or convert Excelsior Springs or anything like that. I just preach the word. Just as it comes to me, as topics come up, I preach them. And usually the Lord ends up using that to speak to people right where they are, to hear right what they need to know, and I didn't even know that they needed to hear it. That happens all the time. There's no grand plan. Not for me. God has a grand plan. I don't have one. I don't know what it is. Just like it says in 2 Timothy 4:2, preach the word, be instant, in season, out of season, reprove, rebuke, exhort with all longsuffering and doctrine. Preachers preach the whole counsel of God, like Paul said. I have not shunned to declare unto you all the counsel of God in Acts 20:27. They preach the whole counsel of God without knowledge of God's grand plan, and then they let God use it to bring the sheep into the church when and how he pleases. We read in 1 Corinthians 12 and verse 18 that the Lord has set members in the body as it hath pleased him. That's what we do. We just preach. I just preach whatever I think you need to hear, and the Lord uses it in His providence to have people out there hear it somehow and hear it when they need to hear it and convict them to come here and eventually to repent, be baptized, and be joined to the church. And I really have nothing to do with it. I'm just a mouthpiece. I just get up here and preach the things that I've studied, and the Lord takes care of it. And I like that a lot better than sales. Because sales, when you're always trying to figure out what the best way to say things is, and should I have said that, or should I say this, or how should I, all this stuff, I don't have to worry about any of that stuff. I just preach the word, that's all. Just that simple. So churches and preachers should therefore focus on serving and worshiping the Lord correctly and let the results up to God. That's what it just comes down to. We just serve God correctly. We keep everything by the book as close as we can, and we just let God sort it out. We don't work on growing the church. We don't work on outreach. We don't do any of that. We just preach the word and live our lives the way that we're supposed to be an example, and we're ready to give an answer whenever any man asketh us a reason of the hope that's in us. Thanks for listening.